The organization warned that more people could die from diseases than bombings in Gaza if the system is not put back on its feet rapidly. The WHO described the collapse of the Al-Shifa hospital in northern Gaza as a tragedy. Israel has repeatedly bombed hospitals in Gaza throughout its brutal war. Meantime, the international charity Save the Children has called for a full ceasefire in Gaza, warning that a failure to agree on a ceasefire would cost thousands of more lives. The charity says that without a complete ceasefire, Gaza's children will be left to live through a nightmare once again. Israel has pounded the besieged Gaza Strip in violation of an extended truce deal with Hamas movement. Tanks fired at Sheikh Radwan, a district in northwest of Gaza City. The regime also launched artillery attacks on the besieged territory. Al-Ghassan Brigade says it's dealt with an Israeli violation earlier today in the northern Gaza Strip. It urged the mediators to pressure the Israeli regime to adhere to all the terms of the truce. The Gaza Health Ministry, meanwhile, says the regime keeps denying hospitals fuel for their generators. That's in violation of the ceasefire. The 40 truce came into effect on Friday after nearly 7 weeks of constant bombardment of Gaza. The airstrikes took the lives of more than 15,500 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Officials say that 7,000 people remain unaccounted for. The Gaza truce deal also includes exchange of prisoners between Hamas and Israel. As part of the agreement, more Palestinian prisoners have been released from Israeli jail. Thirty-three Palestinians were freed from an Israeli jail in the occupied West Bank on Monday. Hamas said it's released 11 Israeli captives. That was the fourth phase of prisoner exchange under the temporary truce deal. On the same day, the two sides also agreed to extend the ceasefire until Wednesday. Hamas says it's reached an agreement with Israel to release 10 captives in return for 30 Palestinians. It's expressed hope that the truce could be extended for a longer period. Under the truce, Hamas has released a total of 69 captives, while Israel has freed 150 Palestinian detainees. Now, many of the Palestinians released from Israeli jails under the Gaza truce deal were children, but hundreds more remain locked away. Now, the next report by Iran's Al Alam Network will hear two released children and family members talk about their plight in Israeli jails and their appreciation of the resistance groups who secured their freedom.
I arrived home with a two-day delay because the Israeli army was attacking the Jenin refugee camp. It's difficult to travel from Ramallah to here because there are so many checkpoints. But thank God, I finally arrived home. After the war in Gaza started, Israeli guards would beat us up in jail and swear at us and fire tear gas at us. Thank God that we were released. I hope the resistance fighters stay safe, and God willing, they will soon celebrate victory.
We are grateful to the resistance fighters. God willing, they will achieve victory against the enemy and secure the release of the rest of the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails.
The conditions were difficult for us after October 7. The Israeli guards would storm our cells and take our clothes. They also cut our food rations.
I have the indescribable feeling of a mother who sees his son after months of imprisonment. Thanks be to God for the breakthrough. We were afraid of the sentences that were due to be handed down. My son was freed in return for the blood of 14,000 Gazan martyrs.
The Israeli onslaught in Gaza has brought almost all vital infrastructure in the besieged strip to a standstill. People are desperate for food, water, and electricity, and some residents recount their sufferings caused by the war. Let's take a listen.
We came to fill with clean water where there's a truce, or now that we still have no electricity, no water, and none of basic necessities. Look how people are standing in line to get some water. Sometimes we wait until late at night to get to our turn. There are many problems. The economic situation is hard. We want this situation to be solved. We are fed up with the lack of water and using fire. There's no gasoline, no electricity, and nothing. Pray for us. That's all I can say.
The struggle for water happens daily since we were first displaced until now. Even during the ceasefire, they didn't find a solution to the water problem. There should be a solution for the water. They said that they have allowed in fuel and aid, but nothing changed. The suffering is the same and getting worse. I call for the extension of the truce and to have a full ceasefire because the people are exhausted, truly exhausted. People are struggling badly to get life's basic needs. The building blocks of life are done. What else do they have? What are they waiting for? For the rest of us to die? What next? It's over.
Now, medics in Gaza have witnessed heart-wrenching scenes caused by Israel's airstrikes and shellings. They struggle to save lives at medical facilities while facing shortages of fuel and medicine due to both the attacks and the regime's full blockade. Let's now listen to a British Palestinian surgeon recounting what he saw and experienced in Gaza. He was speaking at a news conference in London.
One of the most horrific scenes that I witnessed in Shifa Hospital was when, after the air raid and the dead and the wounded were brought in, members of the Shifa medical staff and nursing staff would be running frantically in the emergency department, looking at the faces of the wounded and the dead to see whether their relatives had been amongst the wounded, and in many cases their children had been amongst the dead and the wounded. During my time at Shifa Hospital, it became apparent that 40 to 45% of all the wounded were going to be children. That there were the primary target of the bombing was people's residential homes.
After the attack on Ahli Hospital, I had to take a patient out who had a penetrating neck injury on a stretcher, and I walked into the forecourt of the hospital where the missile had landed. There were lots of bodies lying there, and I remember to my right, as I was carrying the stretcher with three other paramedics, that there was an amputated arm of a child, a forearm of the child on the floor.
Israeli troops have killed three more young Palestinians in their fresh raids on several areas across the occupied West Bank. The regime forces killed Malik al-Barghouti by live fire in the village of Kafr Ain, west of Ramallah. Also, the Palestinian Health Ministry reported a killing of Yassin Abdullah al-Asmer in a raid on the town of Beitounia, also near Ramallah. Another youth, aged 23, sustained injuries there. 14-year-old Ahmed Jamil Wahdan was also killed in a village east of Tubas in northeastern West Bank. The Israeli regime has ramped up attacks across the occupied West Bank since October 7th. That's when Hamas launched a surprise operation against the Israeli regime. Ever since, nearly 230 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. Hamas resistance movement has released a letter by an Israeli captive addressed to the fighters who accompanied her during a period of captivity in the Gaza Strip.
Thanks to you, and thanks to other kind people we met along the way, my daughter considered herself a queen in Gaza. And in general, she acknowledges the feeling of being the center of the world. We haven't met a person on our long journey, from the military to the leadership, who did not treat her with gentleness, care, and love. I will forever be a captive of gratitude because she did not leave this place with a lasting psychological trauma.
Now in the letter, Danielle expresses her gratitude to her captors on behalf of herself and her daughter, Amelia. She describes their treatment at the hands of Hamas fighters as extraordinary and calls their humanity unparalleled. Now, other released Israeli captives also earlier testified to the good treatment they had received while in Hamas captivity. After being released on humanitarian grounds, an 85-year-old Israeli woman said that Hamas fighters provided all the needs of the captives and gave them the same food they themselves had. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called for a further boosting of the combat readiness of the Iranian Navy by using its own existing capabilities. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that efforts should be made to turn the Navy into a comprehensive and strategic force. He referred to the abundant capabilities that the country's naval forces possess, especially their capacity to assist in implementing seaborne economic policies. The leaders stressed the need to explore new capacities in order to enhance the country's strength. Ayatollah Khamenei hailed as remarkable and unbelievable the advances of the Navy since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The leader made those comments addressing naval commanders. November 28th marks the Navy Day in the Iranian calendar. Now, Iran calling an international criminal court to accelerate the investigation of Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. In letters addressed to the court's head and prosecutor, the Iranian foreign minister described Israel's brutal atrocities in Gaza as clear instances of core international crimes. Hossein Mehmet Yollahian said that the perpetrators of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity must not go unpunished. The top diplomat noted the ICC's handling of Palestine case as a test of its independence and impartiality in the face of political pressure from certain world powers. He added that the support that Tel Aviv receives from those states has emboldened it to commit more crimes with impunity. Israel continues with its sporadic attacks on southern Lebanon amid cross-border tensions over the Israeli crimes in Gaza. In the latest assault, regime forces targeted a village there with artillery. We're early joined by Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh, who has more details.
Well, what we do know is that this artillery shell was fired at the outskirts of the village. It was somewhere away from the residential areas because you have a lot of people who went back to their town to check on their property and so on. And so it could have been something that would lead to the killing of civilians. But this artillery shell specifically fell on the outskirts. But this is not the first violation of the truce. If there is an embedded truce within the area of South Lebanon, which was, of course, during the past war, there was always a confrontation. But now we did see a truce in place. However, the Israelis continue to violate it. This is not the first time. Yesterday, we also had another bombs fired at the area of Blot, which is between the towns of Ramya and Nur Ruhin. Today, we have Ait Ashab. We also have the firing of the fact that people they shot at certain civilian cars and also the UNIFIL.
Academic and investigative researcher David Miller says that the people in the West are getting canceled for merely criticizing Israel for its genocide in Gaza.
We've had in the UK, for example, the rector elected by the students of St Andrews University in Scotland, who has been condemned by the management of the university for simply for using the word genocide. And so that's what we see is the attempt to make sure that nobody can actually describe what is actually and very, very visibly happening in Gaza as genocide. And that's what it is. Of course, that's what Zionism is and what it always has been. But many people in the world have only just realized that that's what's happening and what Zionism is about. It's about forcing the Palestinians on pain of death out of their lands and them being colonized. But the attempt is to make sure that no one can properly discuss these things. You reported the arrest of some members of the Communist Party, one of the Communist Parties of the UK, for publishing a pamphlet which mm-hmm. refers to Zionism as being almost like Nazism as a form of racist ideology. And of course, everyone recognizes now, who've seen the images from Gaza, that Zionism is racist and therefore ought to be opposed.
Now, more rallies have been held worldwide in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Protesters are calling for a permanent ceasefire. In France, thousands have demonstrated in Lyon demanding an end to Israeli massacre of civilians in Gaza. In the Spanish city of Barcelona, people took to the streets voicing support for Palestinians while urging the extension of the four-day truce. Americans in New York City gathered in Manhattan, disrupting Black Friday shopping and chanting anti-Israel slogans. Police arrested some 30 people during the rally. Thousands also protested in Morocco's Casablanca, as well as the beachside city of Durban in South Africa. Demonstrators everywhere are calling for an end to the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. The Iranian capital Tehran is hosting a gathering of national and international scholars to review a letter written by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. The letter addressed the youths in Europe and the United States back in 2015. Salman Kujeri reports.
Scholars and thinkers have come together in a meeting at Tehran University to review a 2015 letter sent by Iran's leader to the youth in Europe and the United States. The meeting discussed how the leader's vision is finally being materialized in 2023. In the letter written in January of 2015, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei asked young people in the U.S. and Europe to attain first-hand knowledge of Islam. Ayatollah Khamenei asked youngsters not to allow the states to hypocritically introduce their own recruited terrorists as representatives of Islam. He also points out that with the mass development of social media, people can go beyond their geographical borders and try to view different cultures and religions objectively. Such pieces of advice from the leader have once again been brought to attention as the youth around the globe are showing interest in Islam after witnessing the resistance and faith of the Palestinian people in the face of the Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip.
Instead of money and materialistic possessions, the youth in Western nations can grab onto a more soothing and inclusive philosophy by forming affiliations with Islam.
Some other scholars called the leader's letter a fatherly address, aiming to uproot the xenophobia that oppressive states usually spread in a bid to justify their violence towards the people of a certain land or ethnicity.
The fact is that these letters were seeds that was put on the ground for it to grow and to sort of bring liberation and knowledge and awareness and awakening right across the world, especially with the children, with the youngsters, and youngsters in particular because they are the future. The fact of the matter is that what has happened in the last month and a half since 7th of October reinforced and indeed brought into practice what the letter was trying to achieve. The awakening of people about the fact that Palestinians are the most oppressed and being deliberately massacred in front of our eyes, day in, day out.
Since October 7th, various Western media outlets have tried to justify Israeli crimes in Gaza. Accordingly, they have largely attempted to ignore the vast distress brought upon the 2.3 million people in Gaza in recent weeks. Young people, however, have been taking to the streets in support of Palestine in large numbers after finding out about Israeli atrocities through social media. One of the main goals behind the letter by the leader of the Islamic Revolution to the Western youth was to bypass Western media that do not present facts to their audience, society, as well as young people in Europe and the United States. Salman Kujeri, Tehran.
And that report brings us to the end of this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند
و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, in a couple of episodes, we have dealt with the views of Iranian-Armenian University lecturer Yervand Abrahamian on the character of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution. The gist of his views on Imam Khomeini is that the Imam ably united people from all walks of life under the banner of Islam to struggle against foreign hegemony and domestic despotism. As from this episode, we will make you familiar with the views of John Foran, another Western thinker on the character of the greatest leader of the past centuries, Imam Khomeini. Stay tuned, please. John Foran is a professor in California University, Santa Barbara. He got his specialist PhD in sociology from Berkeley University in 1998. Foran has studied for years on revolutions and social movements in various regions. However, he concentrated his MA thesis and PhD dissertation on social changes in Iran during the recent centuries. His studies led to his authoring of the book, Fragile Resistance. This book made him globally renowned. John Foran has also written dozens of articles on valid dailies and magazines. The American thinker is mostly affected by leftist schools and tries to go through Iran's developments through the same spectacles. Fragile Resistance reviews social developments in Iran during more than half a millennium, that is, from the Safavid rule till the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in early 1979. This researcher, using the theory of development, tries to present a comprehensive review of the Iranian history in these centuries with an analysis of Iran's relations with the West. Foran applies the theory of development in three parts. First, he goes through the pre-capitalist era, 1500 to 1800 AD. Then he gives a picture of the years 1800 to 1925, spanning the era of the Qajari dynasty. In the last part, he reviews the social structure in Iran during the Pahlavi rule. The gist of the book, Fragile Resistance, is that Iranians get united very easily and soon against an enemy. But once they gain victory, this victory becomes shaky and the resistance perishes. The American University lecturer believes that, owing to the interference and infiltration of foreign forces and their support for despotic kings, and the disunity of constitutionalist elements, their movement was deviated from the main route and the resistance of the constitutionalists was broken down. John Foran maintains that the nationalization of oil industry was the second opportunity which the Iranians lost. He opines that the failure of this movement caused the country to be trapped in another cycle of dependent development and compression of social forces by the repressive government. Therefore, the Third Revolution took place with struggles against the internal despotism and external hegemony. In other words, Foran believes that the Islamic Revolution was a combination of the constitutionalist movement against domestic dictatorial regime and the oil nationalization movement against the British dominance. He is of the opinion that both the previous movements were defeated as a result of lack of continuous resistance and perseverance of masses, which paved the way for broader and stronger intervention of foreigners and enemies of the nation. John Foran then points to the developments after the 1953 coup d'etat, which was orchestrated and staged by the British and American spying agencies. This coup created a new era of dependence on the West, especially the U.S. Thus, the United States became the real ruler of Iran as of political, economic, social, cultural, and military decisions and deals had to be confirmed by Washington to put into effect. This excessive dependence on the West, and the U.S. in particular, caused many small producers and businesses lose their job and leave the economic scene. The so-called land reforms by the Shah caused farmers or workers to lose their jobs and evacuate villages. This wrong policy increased the problems of cities manifold and made the rich super rich and the poor destitute. The Shah had turned into a stooge who subserviently and docilely obeyed whatsoever his masters in Washington would dictate him. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was very ambitious, particularly in the field of military expenses. But once the oil revenues shrank, unemployment and inflation surged, resulting in new rounds of foreign loans. The American University professor John Foran believes that these developments led to social dissent and unrest, which ultimately caused the Islamic Revolution in 1978 to 1979. Nevertheless, the opponents of Shah from all walks of life were united under a single banner, which was in the able hands of Imam Khomeini. The Imam invited the people to stage calm and peaceful protests and demonstrations across the country and go on strikes in various economic sections to paralyze the regime. Foran admits that Imam Khomeini was the beloved, charismatic leader of the revolution, who very well united all strata and made them a single voice against the gendarme of the region, as the Shah liked to be called in the years leading to the Islamic Revolution. Dear listeners, in the next episode, we will continue to review Foran's views on Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Tonight the topic is more of how when we put everything together, and what we want to look at is the concept of a functional family. So what makes a functional family? Two verses and we'll end. One is that the family is built on love and compassion for one another. You all know this verse because it's always used whenever there's a wedding invitation. There'll always be a verse at the top of the page from Surah Al-Rum, the chapter of the Romans, verse 21, where Allah says, وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ أَنْ خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مِنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَزْوَاجًا لِتَسْكُنُوا إِلَيْهَا وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمُ الْمَوَدَّةَ وَالرَّحْمَةِ إِنَّ فِي ذَلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِقَوْمٍ يَتَفَكَّرُونَ. That one of the signs of Allah is the fact that He has created mates, your spouse, from amongst yourselves. We don't get married to jinn or angels or hurul ain, right? We get married to human beings. And He says that He has put, or He wants there to be, litaskunu ilayha, that there is sukoon between, there is peace, tranquility amongst the husband and the wife, right? And then He says, وَجَعَلَ بَيْنَكُمُ الْمَوَدَّةَ وَالرَّحْمَةَ. There is love and mercy between the man and the woman. It's not that Allah has to magically infuse it into the family. It's not that Allah has, you know, sprinkled some kind of magic potion on us and now we have love and mercy. No, this is something that we have to work towards, brothers and sisters. It doesn't come overnight, right? You have to marry the person and you grow in your love before them. You know, today I was reading a statistic from Stats Canada. They said in 2021 in Canada, 8 out of 10 couples between the age of 20 and 24 are living common law marriage. Not even married under the rule of God. Just living together as a guy and a girl pretending to be married. 8 out of 10, that's a huge number for Canadian society. Maybe some of those are Muslims. Maybe some of those are from our own community. I wouldn't doubt it, given the state of affairs that we have seen in our own community. Right? But there is no barakah, there's no blessings in that. And many times you'll see that they end up getting married. Right? Allah has not promised this love and tranquility in a haram relationship. You won't find love. Right? You won't find that. It'll be a very open relationship, but there will be no commitment to one another. There'll be no commitment to God in that relationship. But when a man and woman get married in the eyes of God, in holy matrimony, in the way of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, then Allah says, I will ensure that there is sukoon, the tranquility is there, and they will get maybe a boost of love and mercy, and then they will have to continue to develop that within their lives. And you know, that is an entirely separate topic of how do you develop love and compassion, and most of it is rated PG, so I'm not going to mention it on the mimbar. But we have to recognize that this is something that we also need to study. We have to have seminars on marriage, on husband and wife relationships. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who comes from the Islamic Republic, and he was telling me there, it's mandatory for them to take premarital classes. Before they can get their license to be married, they have to take classes in marriage. And I think to myself, we need a license to drive a car. We need a license to go fishing. We need a license to go hunting. We need a license for pretty much anything other than walking down the street and breathing. We need to learn the rules. But as a community of believers, we don't have any marital classes for our youth. We have nothing to tell them. What do you expect from your wife when you get into marriage? Do you think she's your servant, that she cooks and cleans and does your bed and caters to your every whim? It's not like that, right? And the women shouldn't think that, you know, that the men are there, like as we see on the soap operas, that they're this knight in shining armor, right? Yes, the men have a role to play. The women have a role to play. But these have to be taught by not, you know, Netflix and daytime soap operas. This has to be taught by the community, by the religion, by the ulama, the scholars. What is an Islamic marriage look like? You know, it's not as easy as just saying qabiltu and I'm married now. You know, it's one word. It's easy to say, But the process of living that qabilta, that I accept that marriage, is where the challenges begin. You know, and I remember one scholar in North America where he actually has a policy, he won't do any divorces in his community unless he knows that that couple came to him for marriage counseling before marriage. They live in his town, if they come to his masjid, if they haven't taken his marital course, he won't do the divorce for them. Meaning that if you want to get divorced, it's not that easy. You have to have known about marriage. Don't just jump into it blindly, right? And then expect miracles to happen. So Allah says love and mercy are integral to marriage. Verse number 2, and we'll end with this, is that the family, once the husband and wife have solidified that love and harmony amongst the two of them, and God willing, if Allah gives the couple children, boy or a girl or a mixture, or even if children don't come, and maybe they have to adopt in the Islamic way of adoption, or foster child, as some of our community members have gotten into the practice of doing, which is an honorable thing. Then we have to become what I call a family of encouragement. Right? What we see in chapter number 5, Surah Al-Ma'idah, verse number 2, a portion of verse number 2, Allah says, وَتَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَتَقْوَى وَلَا تَعَوَنُوا عَلَى الْإِثْمِ وَالْعُدْوَانِ. Help one another in goodness and piety, and do not become people who help and assist and encourage one another in sins and iniquity and in breaking the laws of Allah. Right? As a family, we have to encourage one another. Whether that is the mother and father waking up the children for namaz, obviously at the appropriate age, I don't expect a mother and father to wake up a 4-year-old at 3 a.m. to pray fajr. It's not wajib for them. And it's not even mustahab for them to wake up to pray fajr. It's not mustahab for our children at the age of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 to fast Ramadan. Don't push it on them. Don't force it on them. Our ulama are clear that we should not be doing this. But when they get 8 years old for girls, 9 years old, 10, 11 for the boys, when the girls a year or two before they become baligha, obviously we have that greater encouragement to begin to wear hijab. I explain it to them why we wear hijab, why we pray, why we fast, the importance of it. As they develop and mature, the parents can encourage and teach them lessons about it. Make it beautiful to pray. Make it beautiful to fast and have iftar together. All of these things are means of encouragement as the family encourages one another. And you'll see that it'll get to a point where the children will actually begin, inshallah, to encourage the parents. The mom and dad might wake up late one day and the child will knock on the door, "Mommy, daddy, it's prayer time. Let's pray Jamaat together. Let's go and pray." This will happen when we encourage our children from a young age, when we have that cohesive, functional family. Our children will actually turn the tables and they will teach us about Islam. They will ensure that we are following it. We might try and skip out as the adults. "I'll pray a bit later." And the kids will say, "No, mom, it's prayer time now. Mom, why aren't you wearing hijab? It's the way of Bibi Zainab. It's the way of Sayyidah Zahra. Look, I'm wearing hijab." And then our children will encourage us rather than us encouraging our children. God willing, a time will change when they will encourage the parents to be the practitioners of the faith.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended his commitment to reducing legal migration to the United Kingdom after the latest figures show a new record high migration to UK for the year to December 2022. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is about to clamp down on immigration and concede in the face of growing Tory anger about his past performance that there is obviously a lot more to do to reduce the record numbers of people immigrating to the United Kingdom. Earlier this week, official figures showed net migration is running at a record high, prompting Boris Johnson, Suella Braverman and other right-wing Conservatives to attack Rishi Sunak for failing to honour the government's 2019 Tory manifesto pledge to bring overall migration numbers down. Sunak initially refused to comment when asked whether he would apologise for failing to meet his pledge. On Thursday, 23rd of November, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, revealed net migration into the United Kingdom peaked at 745,000 in the year to December 2022, meaning nearly 750,000 more people legally immigrated to the United Kingdom than left the country. This figure is three times higher than the levels seen before Brexit. Speaking to the Mail on Sunday, Prime Minister Sunak said, "There is obviously a lot more to do, and that's why we need to take action. I announced previously significant tightening up on the number of dependents that students can bring to this country, which has seen a very striking rise over the past year or two. This represents the single biggest measure of restriction on legal migration than anyone's announced in years. That should give people a sense of my determination to bring these numbers down. As we go over them, as we see other areas of abuse, we won't hesitate to take action and clamp down," he added. Britain's Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick is understood to have worked up a plan designed to appease calls from right-wing Tories for the government to take action. Robert Jenrick's plan is said to include proposals to scrap the shortage occupation list, a programme that allows foreign workers to be paid 20% below the going rate in roles where there is a shortage of skilled workers. The government's Migration Advisory Committee has already recommended the abolition of the list amid fears it is being used to bring cheap foreign labour into the United Kingdom. Number 10 Downing Street refused to say what Rishi Sunak made of Robert Jenrick's proposals when asked by journalists, saying Number 10 would not be getting into running commentary on policy development. However, any attempt to bring down the number of skilled workers arriving in the United Kingdom is likely to be met with anger and resistance by people working in the National Health Service and social care, where there are chronic staff shortages. Sunak tried to defend his immigration record by stressing that there has been a fall in the number of people arriving by small boat across the channel. He said, "I've come into this job, I've had it for a year, and I've already got the numbers down by a third, so I think people can trust me when I say I'm going to do something and I'm going to deliver on that promise. I need to finish the job, and that means getting the Rwanda deal up and running. I'm prepared to do whatever is necessary to get that scheme operational." Prime Minister Sunak has pledged not to let a foreign court stop flights to Rwanda, with plans for a new treaty and emergency legislation to ensure the plan is legally watertight. But it was Britain's Supreme Court rather than a foreign court that dealt the latest blow to the government's hopes of sending asylum seekers who arrive in the United Kingdom on a one-way flight to Rwanda. Prime Minister Sunak also played down claims by Suella Braverman that she had struck a deal with him to lend his leadership candidacy her support in exchange for key promises. "Of course you have conversations with people when you are in a leadership election and not just Suella," Sunak said. Asked about whether she could produce proof of a deal, he said, "That's a question for her. I'm getting on with actually delivering things." In further comments to the Mail on Sunday, Rishi Sunak also said that Jeremy Hunt's record tax-cutting autumn statement is the start of a journey, suggesting he's contemplating further tax cuts before the next general election. He said the government will do more than we can on tax cuts. "I always said I wanted to cut people's taxes, but first we had to get inflation under control and stabilise the economy. We have now done that, and it didn't happen by accident. The Chancellor and I took a set of decisions that weren't easy, that we got a lot of flak for, that the Labour Party opposed in order to have inflation and defy the sceptics. Everyone said we were going to have a recession this year in the United Kingdom, but actually we have grown the economy. Because of that, our economic policy can shift gears." Sunak added, "This is the start of a journey. We will do more when we can because I want to cut taxes further." Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended his commitment to reducing legal migration to the United Kingdom after figures published on Thursday, 23rd of November, showed that it has soared. Net migration to the United Kingdom for the year to December 2022 was revised up from 606,000 to a record 745,000. For the year to June of this year, net migration stood at 672,000. The figures have provoked fury from Conservative backbenchers as the party has promised to cut net migration over its 13 years in government. But the Prime Minister did not apologise for breaking his manifesto commitments when asked, telling journalists, "I'm very clear that the levels of migration are too high and they've got to come down to more sustainable levels. I've been clear about that." It's good to see that the Office for National Statistics on Thursday did say that the levels of migration are now slowing down, in their words, which is a welcome step. However, Sunak acknowledged there was more to do, saying, "That is why I announced a policy earlier to clamp down on the number of dependents that students can bring when they're coming to this country, where we've seen a very significant rise in that number. That action that I took represents the single toughest measure that anyone has taken to bring down the levels of legal migration in a very long time." Rishi Sunak added, "So that should give people a sense of my commitment to bringing migration down. And if we further see abuse of the system, of course, we're prepared to act on that. Asked about the proposals made by his immigration minister, Robert Jenrick, to limit net migration, the Prime Minister dodged the question and repeated his previous answer, adding that there is much more to do. However, there is real fury within the Conservative Party at the latest migration figures published on Thursday, 23rd of November. Net migration to the United Kingdom for the year to December 2022 was revised up from 606,000 to a record 745,000. For the year to June of this year, net migration stood at 672,000. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the organizers of the International Congress in honor of Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai on November 8, 2023. The late Allama Tabatabai was one of the exceptional wonders of our seminaries in the last centuries. The qualities that made up this man's character were all some of the superior virtues of a person. The late Mr. Tabatabai, rahmatullah alayh, was able to form a strong intellectual base using an active, offensive approach. With both his book, The Principles of Philosophy, and also with his explanatory statements, this exegesis is filled with a sea of political and social knowledge. His book of commentary, Al-Mizan, is also about political and social issues that had not even been raised at that time. Today, when we look at these issues, we see that they are also related to the present day. This active and offensive intellectual base was created by the late Mr. Tabatabai. This is one point. That is what I think we should learn from Mr. Tabatabai. We need to form intellectual bases that fill the voids and have an active, offensive nature toward the other side rather than assuming a passive, defensive position.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
His second characteristic, which in my opinion is also a very prominent, important characteristic, is that in the field of monotheistic teachings and divine concepts that he had come to understand, he did not stop at intellectual growth. He grasped those concepts and truths with his noble heart and soul, and he put his knowledge into practice. These characteristics, which he is known for, such as his extraordinary humbleness and not following his desires, were all due to this fact. His patience and his humility were due to the fact that he had grasped those concepts and high levels of knowledge with his soul. When people saw him, it truly seemed to them that he was not concerned with himself. He was patient. He had a very gentle attitude towards others, and he would even treat those who argued with him or had disputes with him with patience and tolerance. He would forgive them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on web.
Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting. And everlasting praise